This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. The other war. Bush just held a press conference a few minutes ago, maybe a half hour ago, thereabouts. And in his press conference,
in addition to members of your own party, the American public is clamoring for a change of course in Iraq. Why are you so resistant to that idea? And how much longer are you willing to give the surge to work before considering a change in this policy?
First, I understand why the American people are, they're tired of the war.
Yeah.
There's war fatigue in America. It's affecting our psychology. I've said this before. I understand that. It's an ugly war.
Oh, so that's it. So we all have war fatigue, and that's why, this is tragic. Lila Al-Aryan is with us. She is with The Nation. Actually, she's a freelance journalist based in New York City, graduate of Columbia School of Journalism. She's interned for USA Today and The Nation, written for UPI and The Washington Report on the Middle East. Her current article is over at thenation.com, the website. It's titled The Other War, Iraq Vets Bear Witness. And this is a dimension of the war that we don't hear much about. Lila, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Great to have you here with us. You write about a brutal side of the war rarely seen on television screens or chronicled in newspaper accounts. The disturbing patterns of behavior by American troops in Iraq. And I want to put this in a frame or a context that I got as a subtext to your article, and tell me if I have this right or not. War is an incredibly brutalizing experience. You are trained for war by being trained to kill people, and then you go into war and you kill people. And murder is the highest prohibition in our society. It's the ultimate crime, the ultimate prohibition, and you're breaking that, and you're breaking it within a legal framework. But nonetheless, you're doing something that from childhood you've been taught not to do, and that I think instinctively as a species we recoil from. And the result of this being forced to be brutal is that the brutality doesn't always stay within the boundaries of the so-called rules of civilized war, end quote.
Right. That's definitely a good way of framing this piece. It's also not just about war, but about occupation and what this occupation has done not only to the Iraqi people, but to a generation of Americans that are coming back and really telling gruesome and heartbreaking stories that will haunt them probably for the rest of their lives.
And this perhaps is one of the largest crimes, in my opinion, of the Bush administration, in not just lying us into the initial war and then completely botching the subsequent 4+ year occupation of Iraq, the ongoing occupation of Iraq. For example, give us some examples here, Lana.
I'll give you some examples. What we did at The Nation magazine is we interviewed 50 Iraq combat vets. So there are 50 soldiers, Marines, and sailors who served in Iraq starting from 2003 until 2006. And they gave on-the-record accounts of their experiences. We asked them to focus on their interactions with Iraqi civilians and specifically incidents in which Iraqi civilians were killed, non-combatants. And we discovered that there are flashpoints of violence in Iraq. We wanted to move beyond the Haditha massacre, move beyond the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, and really take a much broader look at the war and how it affects Iraqi civilians. And what we found is that their checkpoint shootings are pretty common. They're poorly marked. There's a lack of accountability at checkpoints. And to make matters worse, the rules of engagement, we were told, were quite fluid, that basically soldiers were told that they can make whatever decision they felt ensured their safety above all else and that they would be backed up once they made that decision. We also looked at convoys. There's supply convoys that are...
So, may I interrupt you? And
sure.
I just want to drill a little deeper into that. So a checkpoint is where the U.S. soldiers have set up a checkpoint. And people have to stop there and identify themselves or whatever, or slow down, or various rules for the checkpoints. And because they're poorly marked, very often the Iraqi civilians have no idea what it is, and they just try to go around it, or they think it's an accident, or they think somebody's inspecting, the road or something. And by not stopping or by not behaving exactly the right way, particularly if they're being yelled at in English that they don't speak,
right.
These civilians, families, very often, are just slaughtered.
Right, and to make matters worse, not only are they poorly marked, but they're also set up sometimes at a moment's notice and dismantled 2 hours later. So, you can an Iraqi will be driving by their favorite grocery, and all of a sudden there'll be a checkpoint right there where there wasn't 2 hours ago. So they also pop up out of nowhere, and they pose a huge threat to the civilians driving and just trying to go on with their lives.
Okay, so that's one example of where U.S. soldiers with some, what's the frequency of this? How often does this happen that U.S. soldiers are killing Iraqi civilians because, for a moment they thought, oh my God, I'm going to be in trouble here, and then they discovered afterwards that they had killed a carload of civilians? We've seen a few high-profile ones in the news. But.
Right, well, out of the 50 veterans we spoke with, it was a subject that came up time and again, and today actually McClatchy Newspapers came out with a report that pretty much corroborates and backs up our piece in The Nation, and it's basically about how General Petraeus was given figures about how many Iraqis were killed at checkpoints and in convoy shootings, and their cars basically would disrupt a convoy traveling, a formation of American military vehicles, and because they came too close or they approached too close, they would be shot and killed. And so it does seem like it's pretty frequent and much more widespread than previously reported.
So how many soldiers, first of all, these 50 soldiers that you interviewed, were they soldiers, was this a representative cross-section of Iraq war vets, or was this a group of people who had come forward? I mean, how did you select them?
We approach veterans organizations. We talk to two in particular, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and also Iraq Vets Against the War. We also spoke with a pro-war vets group called Vets for Freedom. And basically, a lot of people, it was word of mouth as well. They referred us to their friends. So we tried to get as big of a cross-section as possible. But obviously, when you're talking about hundreds of thousands of soldiers, that's impossible. Another, I did want to hit on another flashpoint of violence, if you will, or cause another instance in which Iraqi civilians' lives are threatened, and that's the house raids. And these house raids happen, you would be hard-pressed to find an Iraqi family that hasn't experienced the terror of what a house raid is. And we have some pretty extraordinary accounts in our piece about incidents that occurred during house raids. In one occasion, a soldier talks about his squad leader shooting a dog because it was barking ferociously, shooting it in its jaw, and the dog was running around spraying blood everywhere until he finally asked his squad leader to shoot him dead because he was in so much pain. So, and this happened in front of three Iraqi children and their parents. And you hear stories like these time and again of just getting the wrong house. We were told over and over again that soldiers just... they were given very poor intelligence, whether it's Iraqis trying to settle family feuds with each other or informants being paid for intelligence and giving false intelligence. They said that this was a very time-consuming and physically exhausting for them.
What's ironic is that we're seeing with the militarization of police in the United States now, on average, three houses a day in the United States have their doors kicked in and people attacked by SWAT teams with absolutely no notice, by accident, wrong house, in the United States. but in any case, I think the biggest problem here that I'm concerned about is what's this doing to our soldiers, the psychological damage that's being done to them. At the time, it doesn't seem like that much of a big deal, or maybe it does, but particularly when they come home.
Right. Well, they are definitely haunted by these stories, and I think that's why they came to us, and they were very ready to tell their stories. They feel that their fellow Americans don't want to hear these stories. I mean, some of them have described them as conversation killers at parties, and They feel like the media also isn't reporting the other war, which is the war on Iraqi civilians, and the incidents of Iraqi civilian deaths are the most thing that seem to stick in their minds as they come home and try to cope with what they've seen and what they've done in some cases.
When we get these reports of 50 or 100 civilians a day dying in Iraq, how many of those are dying at the hands of Americans versus the local insurgents or terrorists?
According to the Lancet report, one-third of violent deaths of Iraqi civilians were attributed to coalition forces. This was the in the British Medical Journal released late last year.
Right. Okay. Lala Al-Aryan, thank you so much. TheNation.com, the website, the article, The Other War, Iraq Vets Bear Witness. Great piece. Thank you.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Political landscape briefings go into individual
Sarah Taylor's
races.
Song.
I would oftentimes give sort of an update on what was going on in the country, and so if it were if we were focused on, you know, people were focused on a certain set of races, I would oftentimes talk about those races, and when I say people, I mean the broad sort of intellectual political community, because people read and they are interested and they want to know.
Sarah Taylor testifying before Congress yesterday. She also said, "I don't remember," over and over and over again. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Just to wrap up this Iraq situation, I find it very interesting that Bush this morning in his press conference is basically saying, "Well, we've got war fatigue. People are just tired of war." Yeah, what a surprise. We, you know, it's taken us longer to secure the road between the Baghdad airport and the city of Baghdad than it took us to defeat Hitler, than it took us to defeat Tojo, and it took us to defeat Mussolini all at the same time. Of course, that was a Democratic president. Now we have a Republican president. Republican presidents not particularly competent at running the government, whether it's running a war or whether it's running the rebuilding of New Orleans. But in any case, Bush painting this rosy picture, and yet at the same time in the media today, I mean in the news, Bob Woodward writing in the Washington Post today, early on the morning of November 13th, 2006, last winter, the beginning of last winter, members of the bipartisan Iraq study group gathered around a dark wooden conference table in the windowless Roosevelt Room of the White House. For more than an hour, they listened to President Bush give what one panel called a Churchillian, as in Churchill, right, vision of, quote, victory, end quote, in Iraq, and defended the country's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, or Maliki, or whatever. A constitutional order is emerging, said Bush. Later that morning, writes Bob Woodward, around the same conference table, CIA Director Michael V. Hayden painted a starkly different picture for members of the study group. Hayden said, quote, "The inability of the government to govern seems irreversible," end quote, adding that he could not, quote, "point to any milestone or checkpoint where we can turn this thing around," end quote. "The government is unable to govern," Hayden concluded. "We've spent a lot of energy and treasure creating a government that is balanced, and it cannot function." Now, this is the guy who's the director of the CIA. He's reporting indirectly to George Bush, and yet Bush apparently doesn't know this. And this was last November. This was 7 months ago, 8 months ago. Hayden went on to say, "A government that can govern, sustain, and defend itself is not achievable in the short term in Iraq." Woodward writes, "In effect, the report from the bipartisan group," this is today's Washington Post, "co-chaired by former Secretary of State James A. Baker III, a Republican," and I might add, the Republican who engineered the theft of the 2000 election in the courts, and former Congressman Lee H. Hamilton, Democrat from Indiana, "was an urgent message from the old Washington establishment to the Bush administration to change the direction of its Iraq policy." Yeah, this ain't rocket science, guys. Hayden is a four-star Air Force general, career intelligence officer, and, as Woodward says, has a reputation as a candid briefing officer. According to the written record, Woodward writes, and others in the room, Hayden at one point likened the situation in Iraq to a marathon. He said, "There comes a point in each race when a runner knows he can complete the challenge, but Hayden said he could see no such point in Iraq's future." Hayden cataloged what he saw. This is, I'm quoting Bob Woodward. Hayden, in today's Washington Post, Hayden cataloged what he saw as the main sources of violence in this order. Now, keep in mind, Bush always says, "Oh, it's Al-Qaeda." Did it again this morning. This is what Hayden says. He says, here's the order. Number one, the insurgency. That is, people who don't want us occupying their country. People who were butchers and bakers and candlestick makers 5 years ago. And they're just saying, get out. I want a job. Number one, the insurgency. Number two, sectarian strife. The Sunnis versus the Shia. People who have always thought, you know, those guys, their religion isn't quite as good as our religion, so we're going to... And now we have an excuse. Number three, criminality. In a situation where you don't have an effective police force, the organized crime gangs come out. And the psychopaths and sociopaths come out. Criminals, number three. Number four, general anarchy. Now we're getting down to the bottom of the barrel here. General anarchy. That's number four on Hayden's list. And finally, the last thing on his list, the least significant source of violence in Iraq, Al-Qaeda. And it's not even Al-Qaeda that has anything to do with Osama bin Laden. It's a bunch of Sunnis in Iraq who have decided to adopt that name because bin Laden was a Sunni, and they kind of, you know, it's kind of cool, let's use that name. But Bush runs around going, it's Al-Qaeda in Iraq, we're fighting Al-Qaeda. As if to say that in Iraq we're fighting the people who struck us on 9/11, not the case. Hayden went on to say, "We continue to be amazed that the Iraqis accept such high levels of violence. Maliki thinks 2 car bombs a day, 100 a day is dead, is okay. It's sustainable and his government is survivable, he thinks. But the government itself is responsible for some of that violence," a CIA official said. "The Ministry of Interior," this is Hayden, "is in uniform death squads, overseers of jails and torture facilities. Their funds are constantly misappropriated. This is what we've created." 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And I'll tell you, one of those saints is Patrick Leahy. We'll get to that in just a second. Welcome back to the program. By the way, congratulations to Design Punk, who yesterday, I neglected to mention it as we were wrapping up the show, yesterday Design Punk's post to yesterday's blog over at AirAmerica.com. If you go to AirAmerica.com, click on the Tom Hartman page, you will get to our blog on AirAmerica.com. And Design Punk had posted what David thought was the coolest blog posting for the day. So Design Punk will be receiving an autographed copy of Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, my new book. Pat Leahy, the saint. I have the video of this, our video of the day, up at the top at TomHartman.com. This is incredible. Patrick Leahy talking to Sarah Taylor. Sarah Taylor was the White House political director. Now, I find that in and of itself fairly weird, that our tax dollars are being used to pay for a White House job called political director. In fact, I'd be very curious to find out when that started. But anyhow, here's Patrick Leahy talking to Sarah Taylor about her oath.
"And then you said, 'I took an oath to the president, and I take that oath very seriously.' Did you mean perhaps you took an oath to the Constitution?"
Yes. Yeah, you're correct. I took an oath to the Constitution.
Did you take a second oath to the president?
I did not.
So the answer was incorrect.
The answer was incorrect.
Thank you.
What I should have said is that I took an oath. I took that oath seriously, and I believe that taking that oath means that I need to respect And do respect my service to the president.
Now, this is where Pat Leahy's eyebrows go up. Because she's basically saying, Bush is king, and I took an oath to the king. And I suppose coming out of, you know, one of these right-wing universities or whatever, who knows? I mean, but he sets her straight and says, no, I'm sorry, George is not the king. And you didn't take an oath to him. And it's just absolutely brilliant. Pat Leahy informing Sarah Taylor about the law in the United States and the nature of government. Again, this is the tragedy of our failure to teach civics, I guess.
No, the oath says that you take an oath to uphold and protect the Constitution of the United States. That is your paramount duty. I know the president refers to the government as being his government. It's not. It's the government of the people of America. Your oath is not to uphold the president, nor is mine to uphold the Senate. My oath, like your oath, is to uphold the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Bingo. It's absolutely brilliant. By the way, just to get back, just to wrap up Iraq, and then I'll take a few of your calls here. The USA Today, front page, Iraqi police assisted gunmen. A previously undisclosed army investigation into an audacious January attack in Karbala that killed five U.S. soldiers concludes that Iraqi police working alongside American troops colluded with the insurgents. Basically, what happened was the police. Well, here's the blow by blow. Iraqi police suddenly vanished from the government compound before the shooting started. Attackers evidently briefed on how U.S. forces would defend themselves, bottled up more than three dozen soldiers in a barracks and headquarters complex using a combination of smoke and fragment grenades and satchel charges to blow up Humvees. Gunmen knew exactly where to find and abduct U.S. officers. Iraqi vendors operating a PX and barber shop went home early. A back gate was left unlocked and unguarded. Now, you tell me these people really are happy that we're in their country. These are the guys working for us who've been vetted, you know, 16 ways to Sunday. And then, of course, our own Pentagon, the Defense Department, this that was today's Oregonian, it's Associated Press story. The Defense Department put U.S. troops in Iraq at risk by awarding contracts for badly needed armored vehicles to companies that failed to deliver them on time, according to a review by the Pentagon's Inspector General. Force Protection of Ladson, South Carolina, failed to meet all delivery schedules. Mike Aldridge, a Force Protection Vice President, acknowledged the delays and said the problems were caused by an inability to get essential manufacturing materials. Gee, could that be because we don't have manufacturing capacity in the United States anymore because we've shipped it all to China? The report, not yet publicly released, also criticizes the award of a $266 million contract for crew protection kits to Simula Aerospace and Defense Group, a subsidiary of Armor Holdings of Jacksonville, Florida. They had no immediate comment. And the leader of a battalion, this also from the Associated Press, involved in the killings of 24 Iraqis in Haditha should face a court-martial for dereliction of duty. So finally, they're going after a lieutenant colonel. Finally, they're going after somebody who is a commander rather than just going after the guys on the ground, rather than just going after the grunts. That's a good step forward. Why don't we take it all the way up the chain? Let's bring Donald Rumsfeld before a court of law and charge him with war crimes. We could start with his supporting of torture. Let's bring George W. Bush. You know, people say, well, I'm not sure if I'm ready to impeach him. Well, I'm ready to impeach him, but I think that we should go beyond that. I'm ready to support Michael Ratner in suggesting that the senior administration official, the senior officials in this administration who lied us into this war and who put together the absolute incompetent and destructive occupation should be in the docket in The Hague, being charged with war crimes. Sheila in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Sheila, welcome to the program. Sheila? I'm not hearing Sheila.
You're not hearing me?
Oh, there you go, Chris. Yeah. Thank you. I'm sorry.
You hear me now?
Yep. Hi, Sheila.
Good. Yeah, I've been thinking about this, too, and I'm very concerned. You know, Congress is being so wimpy. I don't know what they're afraid of. They're afraid of retaliation from the Republicans if they go after Bush and Cheney.
They're suffering from Stockholm Syndrome, Sheila. They're suffering from what is sometimes crudely on the street referred to as battered wife syndrome. They have come to identify with their oppressors.
Yeah, well, the thing is, if they don't get rid of these people, first of all, who knows what they are capable of? I mean, they have their crimes, their goals are so horrible. We don't know. I don't think they're incapable of doing anything to further their goals and anything.
I would submit that they've already demonstrated that. I mean, they've been willing to kill Bush. Bush made the point back in 1999. That he was willing to kill hundreds of thousands of people for political purposes alone. This is Cindy Sheehan testifying before John Conyers Commission, quoting the guy who wrote Bush's autobiography, A Charge to Keep, which you can find in bookstores right now.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
That's a quote from the guy who spent months with Bush tape recording interviews with him for his autobiography. And so we know that in 1999, when he was still governor of Texas, he was saying that if he has an opportunity to, if he becomes president, he's going to invade Iraq for political gain.
Well,
I mean, you say, go ahead.
We've got to do something. People have got to get to their congressman and tell them they must impeach Cheney first and then Bush. The main thing is that I lost my train of thought. The main thing is that if they don't, that Congress will be, they are impotent at this point. They will be worthless. They will be literally worthless. Now we have some opportunity, and we've got to take the opportunity now, or we are finished as a country. We are already in a dictatorship when he can just
tell people
not to testify.
Sheila. No, I understand, Sheila, but let's not slip into hyperbole here, because that diminishes our cause. We are not yet in a dictatorship, but there's serious investigations going on in Congress, and I think that there's a fairly high probability that within the next 2 or 3 months, you're going to see, as a consequence of these investigations by principally by Leahy, Waxman, and Conyers, although there are others, you're going to see clear evidence of crimes that could lead to an impeachment process.
The other serious thing is that we have some of the people on the Supreme Court are thinking of resigning, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. If anybody else leaves the court, he can really, throw this whole thing out, and we have no.
Yeah, but keep in mind, Sheila, if Bush, this is not a panacea. If Bush and Cheney are both impeached, you think you're going to get a Democrat in there?
I don't think it's going to prevent a Democrat from going in.
No, I don't. They're not going to do it in a way that Nancy Pelosi is going to end up as president of the United States.
Because they can't do that. Right. But I don't think we can afford to wait until the term is over.
Yeah. Well, I'm very concerned about that as well. And I share your concern. And Sheila, you said it very well. Thank you very much. It's just amazing. It's just amazing what's going on. Carolyn in Tempe, Arizona. Hey, Carolyn.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I called in when I was hearing you talk about the report on the violence in Iraq. I would just like to remind people.
Carolyn, I missed a time cue here. Let me just put you on hold for a second.
Okay.
And we'll bring you back and you can finish your thought. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program here on Air America Radio. Coming up next, Carolyn. And also, Senator Kent Conrad's going to be with us. Talking about this crazed budget that the Bush administration is putting forward. We'll tell you all about that in a little bit.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
touch me, let me go. I can't serve you anymore. I've done all the damage I can do.
Oh, just please impeach him.
There's only one more thing I can do for you. I'll be your sacrificial lamb.
We'll take you up on that, George.
Serve me up with mint jelly and a side of ham.
Actually, I think I'll pass on that.
And while you're at it, Cheney too.
Good idea.
For once, I'll just tell him what to do. Let's let the world know I atone.
Yeah, well, it ain't. I don't think we're ever going to hear George W. Bush say that. We're just never going to hear him say that. Anyhow, by the way, join us. Seattle's Progressive Talk, AM 1090, is bringing six national talk show hosts to Seattle this Saturday, July 14th, for an AM 1090 forum, Perfect Presidents or Perfect Politicians. It's a one-night event with special guests Stephanie Miller, Ed Schultz, Young Turks, Mike Malloy, and me. I'll be the moderator, in fact. And the tickets are already sold out. But you can watch the live webcast of the event at am1090seattle.com. The night of the show, it's at 7 p.m. Pacific time on Saturday. And also, I'll be in Grand Rapids the following week for a special live broadcast and book signing Friday, July 20th at the Celebration Cinema North. I'll be looking forward to meeting you, and for information, you can visit WTKG.com. Those of you listening on WTKG in Grand Rapids, great Clear Channel station. We've been on for, going on 4 years now, I think. I'll be giving a talk at Schuller's Bookstore in Grand Rapids that night at 7 p.m. as well, signing books and talking with you, so drop by. 9:52, and let's see, we were talking with Carolyn, weren't we? Carolyn, welcome back.
Yeah, hi, Tom. There again, when you were talking about the violence in Iraq, what really concerns me is that the Bush administration is terrorizing the American people and the people of Iraq. And they're busy doing the same thing to the people in Iran. I heard an interview with an ex-MI6 agent who is a linguist.
MI6 being the British equivalent of the CIA.
Yeah, last night. And it wasn't anything that really that I hadn't heard before, but it still is chilling. What people have got to wrap their minds around is what these people are capable of. The death squads, and I would just like to remind people that can check this out, but the death squads did not show up in Iraq until after Negroponte had been sunned over there.
Yeah, in fact, I predicted that. When Negroponte went over there, I pointed out that when he went down to El Salvador, within a month of his showing up in El Salvador, there were death squads in El Salvador. And I said, it'll be interesting to see how long it takes before we start seeing bodies show up with the hands handcuffed behind them, blindfolded with a bullet in their head. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, it started.
Right. And anyone who doesn't believe it can simply just trot on over online to the National Security Archives and do a search on Negroponte and read all about it.
Yeah, no, it's not a secret.
There was a story that people have by now no doubt forgotten where British were caught and arrested by Iraqi police. They were in a car disguised as Iraqis of some description. I forget whether it was Sunni or Shia. And they had, you know, all these explosives in the car for a car bomb. And then I believe the British or the American, I forget which, came along
with
a tank and broke them out.
Yeah, they were arrested by the Iraqi police because these were British soldiers dressed up like Iraqis running around blowing things up. And again, this isn't some weird conspiracy theory. You can find it in the New York Times.
It's reported.
And, Yeah, and the British took a tank and smashed the jail down, the wall of the jail, to get these guys out. Carolyn, you're spot on, and I really appreciate your making the point. And the fact that this administration is essentially operating, just as the Republican Party is operating as an organized crime ring, it's operating very much like the mafia, and I really think that the RICO laws should be brought to bear on them. This administration is operating in ways that are eerily reminiscent of previous governments in other countries that have operated functionally as terrorists against their own people, using the instruments of government to terrify their own people. Richard in North Bergen, New Jersey. Hey, Richard.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
I can. You're on the air.
Yeah, one of the points that Bush made this morning on his press conference, and I use that in quotes, he said that Al-Qaeda in Iraq has sworn an oath of allegiance or something like that to bin Laden.
Osama, yeah.
And I'm just thinking what they do it in the Iraqi equivalent of Nuremberg with the Al-Qaeda flags flying and the band playing and all stood up and raised their right hand or whatever and put the other one on the Quran or some other document and they'll faithfully
The reality is, Richard, that some of the, I'm sorry, the echo is just terrible here. Some of the folks in Iraq who are part of the insurgency, who are Sunnis, who have decided that they don't just want to get rid of us, but they also want to get rid of us, and they're going to use it to advance their religious, their sectarian goals, have said, yeah, we're in with bin Laden. But they're not working for him. They're not talking to him. They're not communicating. He's not directing. There's no relationship, no functional, no operational relationship. And this is from the CIA, by the way, between the guys in Iraq who are trying to throw us out of their own country and bin Laden in Pakistan. Now, it looks like there's a very high probability that bin Laden has reconstituted himself in Pakistan because Bush has done for 5 years absolutely nothing about going after Osama bin Laden. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if he's sent some folks into Iraq. I mean, what a great training ground. You want to learn how to be a soldier? You want to learn how to be a jihadi? Go into Iraq. The Americans have set up a Disneyland of training here. It's boot camp for us, for them. I mean, speaking as them. But it's not how it started out. It's what we have created there. We played right into his hands. We gave Osama bin Laden everything he wanted, including his life.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Welcome back. One of the most brilliant writers in America. The first of his works that I read was The Bush Dyslexicon, which was absolutely a shocking book. This was years ago. Mark Crispin Miller, brilliant guy, has his book Fooled Again is now out in paperback, and with over 100 pages of new material. Fooled Again, the real case for electoral reform. By the way, welcome back to the program, 6 minutes past the hour. And Mark Crispin Miller is with us here. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Great. Great to have you with us. Your website, by the way, markcrispinmiller.blogspot.com. Is that your main website?
Well, it's actually just markcrispinmiller.com. It's as simple as could be.
That works even better.
Yeah.
Mark, before we get into the stuff about the book, Rush Holt's bill, and Chris, you're going to have to ride that thing. That echo is terrible. Rush Holt's bill is on a fast track, and it appears that the voting machine companies have been lobbying pretty aggressively on this and have modified it.
Yes, that's absolutely right. People have to understand that Rush Holt's bill, H.R. 811, has been very radically altered since it was first written by Holt and others months ago. It's called an election reform bill. It's very important for people to understand that the bill will actually make the situation even worse than it was before for several reasons, the most important of which is that the software, the voting machine companies basically did not just, you know, lobby for the bill. They had a hand in rewriting it. Specifically, H.R. 811 originally stipulated that the software used by the, you know, the companies that make these e-voting machines must be publicly available. Now, I don't believe in these computerized voting machines, and I don't believe in privatized voting, and I don't think these companies should have any influence whatsoever on our election system. Nevertheless, it was a step in the right direction, certainly, to require that the software, the crucial software for these machines, be available to the public for anyone's scrutiny, because that way, if there's something fishy about the software, people could call attention to it and it might be fixed. Now,
yeah, and in fact, I went back on my own archives. If you go to TomHartmann.com and click on the archives, and we have Michael Toth keeps a collection of interviews and archives, you know, by topic. And almost 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago or thereabouts, I interviewed Rush Holt when he first put the bill together. And that's what he said. He said the software should be open. It should be inspectable by anybody. We're going to require that. You know, at that time, I was supporting his bill. And it was when the thing first came out. And it was, you know, a very friendly interview, although I did ask him, you know, why should we have any private companies involved in this thing at all? And he didn't have much of an answer for that.
Right.
But now he's apparently changed his tune, or at least his bill has.
Well, his bill has definitely changed its tune. The amazing thing is I was told straightforwardly by Rush Holt's own counsel, Michelle Mulder, and this whole story is up on my blog at markcrispinmiller.com. She told me in an email outright that Microsoft and others in the proprietary software industry, which can only mean companies like Diebold and ESNS, insisted on changing that language, the language that Holt basically described to you. Now, the only people who can look at the software are, quote, qualified, unquote, persons, and they must sign non-disclosure agreements in order to take a look at the software. This means that if the bill should pass in its current form, and you're absolutely right, it has been fast-tracked, if this bill passes, it means that if anyone is privileged to take a look at this software and find something wrong with it, they will face stiff penalties like jail time if they dare to blow the whistle, you know, if they go so far
like Bev Harris did,
to say publicly, hey, there's something wrong with the software. So some guy at Coca-Cola just went to jail for 8 years for violating one of these non-disclosure agreements. The very idea that people who look at this kind of material have to sign agreements like that is grotesque. In a word, what has happened to the Holt bill is that it is now one that favors trade secrecy over the necessary openness of democracy. It will actually put us in a worse place than we are in already. So I urge people in the strongest possible terms to contact their congressmen and congresswomen and say, look, delay this bill. It's got to be revised. And if it cannot be delayed, vote against it. With reformists like this, I'm telling you, we don't need the forces of evil. And as I also point out in this blog entry, Rush Holt has headquartered in his district a leading company that deals precisely in paper trail technology. It's called Avante International. The more closely we look at Avante, which is located right in Princeton, Rush Holt's, you know, territory, the more we find that they're involving themselves in all kinds of shenanigans. Here in New York, for example, they're suing the other voting machine companies. They're clearly intent on making a kind of monopoly for themselves. So all of this is, first of all, you know, appalling on its face. Second of all, the press isn't covering it, so it's only because of people like you, having people like me on the air, that anyone even hears about it. But the long and short of it is that we have to get real election reform in this country with no private companies involved, a system that is overseen and managed not by the political parties, but by the people. I believe we can get that. I think most Americans want that, but we're not going to get it if we don't, you know, make a big loud noise over it.
Yeah. Now, we're talking with Mark Crispin Miller. His new book, Fooled Again, is out. New subtitle, The Real Case for Electoral Reform. And it's brilliant. Over 100 pages of new material. Even if you already have Fooled Again, it's worth picking up this new edition. Mark, the crimes of 2000, 2002, 2004, 2006, lay them out for us in very short form. We've only got about 2 minutes left.
You mean all the stuff that's gone down in all those elections?
Yeah, I mean, brought in 2 minutes. I know.
Well, let me simply say this, that the case has been made. This is not a speculation. This is a fact. Bush Cheney stole their reelection. My book is not the only one to make this case. Many, many books and articles have been written about it, about the 2000 election, and about some of the congressional victories by the ultra-right in 2002 and 2006. The case has been made. However, the establishment, by which I mean both parties and the press, have absolutely refused to cover this issue. They have, in essence, buried it. The new afterword to Fooled Again tells this story in detail. And the most shocking thing about it, Tom, as far as I was concerned in looking at what I had written, is the fact that the left press has actually done the most damage of all, because while the mainstream media primarily contented itself with ignoring the issue, The Nation, Mother Jones, TomPaine.com, Salon actually went out of their way to try to, quote, debunk, unquote, the, quote, theory, unquote, of election fraud. Now, as I demonstrate, you know, over many pages with meticulous care, the whole case that there is no evidence of fraud is itself a fraud. And it is really an eye-opening read. The afterword does that. It tells that story of the press's cover-up of what's been going on. And it also has a great deal to say about the extent of fraud and vote suppression tactics in the 2006 elections. Because the Democrats got to win 29 House seats, that is to say, those victories were permitted to them, because they're afflicted with battered spouse syndrome, they didn't dare look into the many other races that they probably also won. I mean, there are four Florida Democrats, for example, who have contested their ostensible defeats in 2006, and three of them have actually gathered together documentary proof that the official vote count was false. They went door-to-door collecting signed affidavits from individual voters. This is Clint Curtis and people like that. This is proof, not just evidence, proof that the official vote counts were fraudulent, and the House Administration Committee, now Democratic-controlled, unanimously refused to look at their evidence and rejected their request for an investigation.
Yeah, so yeah, the Democrats are just, they're terrified of this because they think that if people think the votes are rigged, they won't vote.
Well,
and I think if people think the votes are rigged, that will turn out in even larger numbers.
That's exactly what we've got to do.
I mean, that's what you said on this program before the last election. They're going to steal 4 million votes. We need to turn out 5 million voters, or 5 and 6 or whatever it was. Mark Crispin Miller, the book Fooled Again, the website markcrispinmiller.com. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Yes, turn on your radio. And by the way, while you're at it, if you have a web browser up, head over to airamerica.com, click on my name. It'll take you to the Tom Hartman page, where you will see it's called the Louise Hartman blog. Because she puts up our info every day. And feel free to post something. You know, at the end of the day, David's going to pick out somebody from one of our posters. He's going to pick out a post, and we will send that person a free copy of my new book, an autographed free copy, my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. So there you go, an opportunity to have some fun and, you know, who knows, maybe get a book too. And now time for our crazy alert for the day. This is an interesting juxtaposition here. First of all, a California study says a little anger can help people make better decisions. Researchers at the University of California, Santa Barbara said getting miffed or irked can sharpen a person's ability to analyze data carefully and make the right decision, according to ABC News. The study was published in Personality and Social Psychology Bulletin. Psychologist Wesley G. Moons and a colleague put students through a series of experiments to see if they could think straight while seeing red, and it turns out they could. In fact, they thought better. Well, it doesn't always work that way. On the other hand, this is the Associated Press in Bohemia, New York. There were flashing lights atop his SUV and what appeared to be a police badge in his hand. Unfortunately for the fake cop, the man he pulled over was a real police detective. Robert Lane, 25, was arrested Tuesday on charges of criminal impersonation and aggravated unlicensed operation of a motor vehicle, Suffolk County Police said. Lane was driving an SUV fitted with flashing lights when he tried to stop the off-duty New York police detective on a highway in Long Island, Suffolk police said. They said Lane told investigators the detective had cut him off. So let me get this straight. This guy has road rage. And so because he apparently so enjoys it, he outfits his SUV with cop lights, you know, with police lights, with flashing lights, and gets himself a phony badge. And some guy cuts him off, and so he pulls him over, and the guy who cut him off was a cop. I don't think that's all that bright. I just don't think it's all that bright. Oh, man. By the way, still caging after all these years. We were just talking with Mark Crispin Miller. And it seems that the caging is still going on. I mean, this is, I think, a very, very serious concern. Voter caging, is this tool still in the RNC arsenal? And media has identified three individuals working within the Republican Party's 2004 election apparatus who may have been a party to what some have alleged was ballot security program known as caging. That's Sean Reinschmidt, Christopher Carr, and Rich Beeson, along with Tim Griffin. And they were on the email distribution list. Some of these ended up in Mark's email box. Reinschmidt was a senior research analyst for the RNC. He was copied on the August 26, 2004 email sent by Kelly Porter, the Republican Party to Florida, to Tim Griffin with the caging list attachment that E Pluribus Media analyzed as part of a recent article on voter suppression. This from an epluribusmedia.org, by the way, article. Reinschmidt was also the recipient and contributor to email discussions about the creation of lists for possible voter challenges in Ohio and other states, including Nevada, Florida, Pennsylvania, and New Mexico. Members of the Ohio Republican Party, Ohio GOP, Bush Cheney 2004 campaign officials, and other RNC officials were among those included in this email exchange. They have a copy of one of the exhibits from District Court of New Jersey. The emails were included in a 2004 suit in the U.S. District Court of New Jersey. In this suit, voters in Ohio took the RNC to court in New Jersey to argue that their plan to challenge voters in Ohio violated the 1982 and 1987 consent decrees in which the RNC promised to stop what I would characterize as behaving like the mafia. What the courts characterize as caging or illegal suppression of voting. The Third Circuit Court of Appeals agreed with the district court ruling. Now, the RNC lost this case. They said, quote, the emails between the RNC and Michael Megan for the Ohio Republican Party Exhibit 1 show collaboration and cooperation between the RNC and the Ohio Republican Party. They note in this article, by the way, over at E Pluribus Media, they note that during the same time, Chris Carr was the executive director of the Nevada Republican Party. Carr forwarded an email on September 20th, 2004, to RNC and Bush Cheney campaign officials, including RNC Mountain Regional Director Rich Beeson. You know, the bottom line, and this was had a spreadsheet attached to it titled Douglas County Voter Fraud Master Spreadsheet.xls. And it was the names of people who were collected because they had, quote, returned mail from Douglas County. This is caging, where they send out mail to people who are registered to vote, and if it bounces back, then they challenge those people at the polls when they show up. Well, maybe they moved. Maybe they decided that they didn't want to take what they thought was junk mail from the other party. Maybe they were out of town. Maybe they were in Iraq. Who knows? But this is illegal. And the Republican Party is apparently still doing this. In the early part of 2007, Mike Duncan, chairman of the RNC, announced new staff joining the RNC communications and political team. Who? Rich Beeson is going to be the political director. Christopher Carr is going to be the regional political director in the Northwest. And Sean Reischmidt, director of research. These are the guys who are doing the caging. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Save us from hypocrisy. Save us from the lies. Save our homes from foreclosing. Stop treating us as spies. Save our jobs from leaving. Bring back made in USA. Represent the ones who made you, not the ones who paved your way.
Okay, so let's get this straight. Now, Bud Cummings... Let me just get this. I understand this whole process here. Bud Cummings was the assistant to Karl Rove. I'm sorry, he was the U.S. attorney in Little Rock. And Timothy Griffin was Karl Rove's assistant. And Bud Cummings thought he was just doing a fine job and he was having a great old time being U.S. attorney down in Little Rock. And all of a sudden, he's told he's out of here. And he's said that on the record. You know, he wasn't planning to step down. He was liking his job. I mean, he said that in the press. In fact, nobody even informed his superiors of the Justice Department that he was leaving, and he hadn't requested to be replaced. Paul McNulty, the Deputy Attorney General, said in sworn testimony under oath before the Senate Judiciary Committee last February that the U.S. attorney in Little Rock, Cummings, had been fired so that Karl Rove's fair-haired boy, Tim Griffin, could take his place. Well, this is what Sarah Taylor said yesterday in front of the United States Senate. A little different, slightly different story, as they say.
With respect to the departure of Mr. Bud Cummings, who had been the United States attorney in Arkansas. To your knowledge, what were the circumstances of his interest in staying on or leaving?
You know, I had heard a while ago that he had planned to leave. I had read a press account that
A while ago is when?
I don't know the specific time range, Senator. I had heard that he had been considering this, and maybe even as early as 2004 had indicated that he may be thinking about leaving.
But in any of did Mr. Rove or Ms. Myers intervene in the replacement of Mr. Cummings with Mr. Griffin?
I can't answer that. I'm trying to answer your questions and respect the...
Can you not answer it because of the privilege or because you just don't know?
I don't specifically know. I don't know for sure.
Interesting. And this is, by the way, Josh Marshall over TalkingPointsMemo.com has pulled together a great summary of Sarah Taylor clips, and TPMMuckraker.com is where they're all summarized. She really painted herself into a corner here. She started out by saying that she couldn't talk about whether or not President Bush, George Bush, was involved in the decisions to fire U.S. attorneys because they weren't, for whatever reason. I mean, it's fairly obvious now that the decision to fire them had to do with the fact that they were not aggressive enough in prosecuting Democrats. And she says, first of all, she says, I can't address that issue because I have this letter. And then about 3 hours later, 2 hours later, toward the end of her testimony, she's asked the exact same question again, and she says, no, Bush didn't have anything to do with that. He didn't know about it. And the whole assertion of executive privilege was based on the fact that Bush has to be able to get advice from people, and if Bush wasn't involved in the process, there's no executive privilege here. So, and this is the path that they're gonna come back and go after her with on this, and I think it's a good one, because she kept pulling this letter out. I mean, here's another one, Dianne Feinstein.
Who decided which U.S. attorneys to fire, and why were they selected?
I'm trying to do the best I can here and following the president's assertion of executive privilege and determine what is a deliberation and what is a fact-based question. So I really appreciate the committee's
understanding. Yeah. Okay.
You declined to answer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I declined to answer. So I wonder how it's going to be if Congress ever gets any of these. Now, we have three officials who have been appointed to high positions within the RNC who are all implicated in these in this 2004 lawsuit against the RNC by the Democrats for caging. And there's evidence of it. I mean, they actually have the caging list. They actually have the emails between these guys. Why aren't they being called up before? Well, maybe they will be. Maybe they will be. Maybe the Democrats are starting to shake off the Stockholm syndrome. We'll see. Joe in Long Island, New York. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program.
Yeah, how you doing, Tom? Yeah, my question is this. When I was in the military, we used to have sensitive, even crypto equipment that was built to military specifications. Why can't we have voting machines that are built to government specifications that there's no propriety issue, it's government initiated, it's built by government contractors that are, you know, okayed by the government and given clearances. I mean, the government can build their own voting machines, and there's no need for propriety. I don't understand it.
Well, there's a very simple answer to the question, Joe, and you've asked the $64,000 question, and the answer is that it's more profitable for the companies if they can control the software and keep us away from it. It's just like with pharmaceuticals. Everybody wants to come out with the new pill that's patented so that they can charge $15 a tablet for it instead of, you know, a dollar for a bottle of 100 with the generics.
Right, right.
It's the exact same thing. So that's the bottom line. Thanks, you know, you really nailed it. And this is why it's absurd. It's obscene that we have allowed the beating heart of democracy, our vote, to be privatized. It's nuts. People say, well, you know, the first voting machines were in the 1964 election. You know, Goldwater Johnson. True. And they were lever machines. True. But there was no proprietary software. You could lift up the back of that machine and see the little wheels going around. It was completely transparent. And the machines were sold to government and owned by government, just like Joe just suggested. This is a whole different thing. This is a completely whole different thing. Charlie in Brooklyn. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Tom. I really appreciate both topics. With Sarah Taylor yesterday, I think it was Senator Cardin of Maryland who called her on the fact that she'll make self-serving statements for the Bush administration, but anything that might challenge them, she says, I can't answer. And that's not exactly, you know, using the privilege fairly. But with this voting machine stuff, followed under the category of won't get fooled again, you know, HAVA, the thing that put this horrible privatized system into place, was the bill that Bob Ney had promised Abramoff that he could get the favors in for the Coushatta Indian tribe. He says, I'll load that onto that package. That's how they looked at trying to help us vote better. It was a way to commit fraud. And right now in the 13th District of Florida, maybe Mark Crispin Miller didn't get to it because of time, Christine Jennings won that election, but they awarded the seat to Vern Buchanan. He supposedly won by 300 votes. She went to court because there were 18,000 votes where people voted for everything else, dog catchers, you know, city council, but no vote for the House of Representatives.
Right, and that district encompasses four counties, three of which are largely Republican and one of which is almost entirely Democratic. And the 18,000 missing votes were all from the one county that was largely Democratic.
Absolutely. And if you, I wish
this is Catherine Harris's old district, by the way.
I wish you'd
that should tell
up
you something.
Because she went to court. She wasn't taking this lying down. And the court came back with the same argument that they're using now to load up the Rush Holt bill, that it's proprietary source code and they can't reveal it. Because she wants a recount. She wants them to show the codes. They won't do it. So this collusion of private industry and now Bush appointees in the courts makes it very difficult if we don't.
Well, the problem is that court ruling was correct. It is private software. It is protected by secrecy laws. It is protected by patent laws. And that's why it never should have been allowed in the first place.
Right.
That's why, you know, know, it's just like saying, gee, it's a crime that we've got private corporations running the concessions in Yellowstone, and you know, not just the food ones, but now the skidoos or whatever, you know, the snowmobiles and things like that, and it's getting larger and larger, you know, more and more. Or it's a crime that we've privatized so much of our military, or it's a crime that we're now privatizing the CIA and all these things. But you can look at the individual circumstances, like the case in Florida, and say, yes, that's terrible and that's a crime. But the bigger crime is the privatization in the first place, just the whole concept of privatizing.
Last thing, Tom, you know, you see Zawahiri issuing threats to England because they awarded Rushdie an award. Every Bush invokes al-Qaeda every opportunity. Why didn't we get bin Laden at Tora Bora? Because we privatized out the mission. We paid off some tribes because we didn't want to use soldiers there. God knows we can let soldiers die every day in Iraq, but when it came to taking bin Laden out, privatized
it. No, you're absolutely right, Charlie, and that's another grim irony. Craig in Berkeley, we have about a half a minute, Craig. You had a quick question?
My question is, do people know when their vote has been caged?
Yes, by and large, there is a way to at least have a strong suspicion, and that is when you show up at the polls to vote. If they say, I'm sorry, I can't find your name on the list, you're going to have to vote on a provisional ballot. Here's a provisional ballot. Please vote on this instead of the normal ballot. Odds are you've been caged. And, in fact, there's over 100,000 provisional ballots in Ohio right now sitting in a warehouse someplace from the 2004 presidential election that have not yet been counted. Provisional ballots are almost never counted because they're only counted if the general election would have been affected by, you know, those provisional ballots swinging the vote. And in Ohio, they said, you know, 100,000 ballots, it's unlikely that's going to change the vote. So they were never counted. And that odds are those were 100,000 people who were caged, which means that 100% of them were Democrats. And if 100,000 votes had flipped in Ohio, Kerry would have carried Ohio. Thanks, Craig, for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Hey, we have a new comment line. Well, actually, it's an old comment line, but it's working again. If you don't get through to the live show, or if you're listening to a time-delayed show, or if you just, you know, one of those people who doesn't want to mix it up with me, but you want your opinion to be on the air, particularly if you disagree with us, feel free to leave a message. The comment line number, and you'll find this on my homepage at tomhartman.com. The comment line number 503-323-6620. Please limit your comment to no more than 30 seconds, and remember that we may use your voice and opinion on the air. It's the Tom Hartman Program comment line, 503-323-6620. Ellen Renner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, I've been wrecked to death today.
You've been racked to death?
The president had a news conference, and then the Democrats had a news conference, and then the Republicans had a news conference. And it's been a rack 24/7 today because of two things. One is the benchmark report, and then this other report about al-Qaeda and whether they're strong or not. Now, the president said in his news conference that al-Qaeda is not necessarily stronger, that this war has actually reduced al-Qaeda. Some of us... But at the same time, that what they're saying is that we've been able to reduce al-Qaeda. They're also saying both, and I was just at downstairs with Lieberman and those folks, I'm up at the Senate right now, they were saying al-Qaeda, 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 al-Qaeda. Well, either you've reduced al-Qaeda or al-Qaeda is the main enemy. And what's so interesting about this is that this is really about, Iraq is at this point really about power and control. And so in terms of all of that, al-Qaeda is just one group with a dog in the fight. They are not the only enemy there. If you took every al-Qaeda, supposed al-Qaeda person out of Iraq, you still have the Shiite-Sunni situation. And,
well, and you still have all the guys who just don't want us in their country. That's well, that's the leading thing. It's
well,
the insurgency.
Of course, but. Well, but even in terms of if we got out, let's say, and you took Al-Qaeda out, there's still going to be a problem in the country. And so this is just, this is oversimplification. This is trying to justify, justify this. And the Republicans.
Well, this is a backdoor attempt to conflate 9/11 in Iraq, Ellen.
Well, yes, and he did mention that again today. And the other thing he said is that basically Congress's main responsibility, the president said this, is to fund our troops. Congress's
their main responsibility is to give
to fund
him
our troops. I was like in shock.
Yeah, yeah, me too. Hey, this is the first time I believe you and I have talked since you traveled with the president on his little trip to Ohio, isn't it?
Yes.
And I'm curious what your impressions were of that trip.
Well,
you said it was the first time you actually traveled with George Bush.
It's the first time I have actually traveled out of the Washington area with George Bush since in his second term.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have to say this. First of all, he was eloquent. He was took all the questions, which were not they were not set up questions, although it was a sort of an audience that was made up of essentially a chamber of commerce. He even took questions about the American Indians, and he did a very good job. He was very good at the press conference today, so he's really gotten confident. But of course, as I pointed out, somebody 6 years of briefing, so you're going to get very confident. And a lot of people in the audience did not clap when he talked about immigration. At least half did not clap when he talked about the war. I'm not sure he won over anybody, but he clearly was there to stick it to Voinovich, because I found out from somebody in the audience, this Cleveland Plus group that invited everybody, is essentially that he was the one, the White House called them on Thursday asking to come to Cleveland, and could they put a group together. So you know as well as I know that the White House said, we got to go to Ohio, we got to make somebody.
What was this, on Wednesday Voinovich had come out against the war, and on Thursday Bush calls up and says, can we come? Was it something like that?
That's pretty much how it looks like it happened. And, you know, the other thing I learned traveling with the president is that several of the press people did not leave the press room to come up to where the president was, some of the audio people and other people, because they had to get their stories written, et cetera. So they weren't able to see or talk to the people in the audience and weren't able to see the reaction, nor were they able to find out what happened and how this whole thing happened. And that's the problem. If you're not there a fair amount of the time, you're not able to get that.
I've talked with two or three people now who have actually interacted with Bush in public, in these public dialogues. And one of them actually, a 9/11 widow, one of them the mother of a soldier who died in Iraq, and one of them a guy who asked Bush a question in a press conference, or in one of his public events, a rather difficult question. And all of them have said that he was incredibly charming. He made you feel like he really liked you, and just this very charming guy, which is not the impression that you get from watching TV. Was that your sense of how he was perceived by people in the audience?
Yes, even the people who sat stone, as if they were stone, when he was talking about immigration or the war, did stand up and clap for him. He was very good. And you know, I've got to tell you, this is going to make some of your audience mad, some of our audience mad, but he's very similar to Clinton in many ways.
In other words, he has the charm. He has the ability
to. Clinton would stand up there in front of the press corps and say, not one Russian missile is pointed at our children, and I've made the world safer, and everybody would love it, love it, love it. Well, the fact is, you can reposition those missiles in 15 minutes. But he would get up and say that, and nobody ever questioned him, and he came off very smooth, and I just happen to like Clinton's politics on level a whole lot more than I like George Bush's. But they're very similar people.
Yeah, well, I was so impressed by Bill Clinton's ability to, I introduced him in Seattle when he came for a fundraiser for Jim McDermott. And you meet the guy, and within a minute, you feel like he feels like you're his best friend.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's amazing. It's just amazing. Anyhow, it's brilliant politics. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
Coming up in the next hour, Senator Kent Conrad going to join us about the OMB budget.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Investors in European and U.S. credit markets. This from today's Financial Times of London. Investors in European and U.S. credit markets accelerated their flight from risk yesterday, as the turmoil from the U.S. mortgage markets continues to spill over into other asset classes. You'll recall I went off on a rant about this yesterday that at a certain point I think got sufficiently complicated that even I was confused. But actually I wasn't, but you start getting into, well, this is going to affect security, asset, the bottom line. The change in sentiment, which triggered sharp moves in credit in the credit derivatives markets, these are markets where people are buying and selling debt. Debt being bonds. Bonds being the things that corporations and governments issue in order to borrow money. So, you know, if Ford has a bad year, they need to borrow money. Or if they want to expand, they need to borrow money. Or if GM is, you know, or if the U.S. government wants to fight a war in Iraq, they have to borrow money. And boy, are we borrowing money, by the way, for our war in Iraq. And those borrowing instruments, those debt instruments, are again sold, or, you know, they get resold, and they get packaged together, and they get sold, and that's the credit. And then there are people who even, you know, turn them into things like mutual funds and stuff. That's all the credit derivatives market. And it's crashing. And in credit derivatives market, it's suggesting that recent problems in the subprime mortgage sector could be spreading to other corners of the financial world. That's what I was saying yesterday. If I had an adjustable rate mortgage, I would be changing it to a fixed rate mortgage no matter what it cost tomorrow morning, if not this afternoon. And trying to get as liquid as I can. I mean, that's one dimension of it. Another dimension of it is, you know, we started out this program back two hours and change ago talking about what's going on in Iraq. And Bush has so far, well, not, I shouldn't even say Bush. The Republicans have so far borrowed $442 billion, borrowed and spent. They've actually borrowed more than this. This is just for Iraq. Borrowed and spent $442 billion. 506,969,126. Whoops. Now it's 442,506,989,995,000. I'm watching this counter at costofwar.com, and it's just ticking along. I mean, there goes another thousand, another thousand, another thousand, another. Oh, there goes another 5,000. Another 5,000. Another 5,000. Excuse me, 50,000, another 50,000. I mean, that's how fast it's going. And this $442 billion that we have spent so far in Iraq, you know, what could we have done with that? This is where it gets real for people. And I think it's you know, really important to consider. What could we have done with that? You say, well, you know, if we're going to ship all our manufacturing jobs overseas, we need to teach people how to do things. People need education. With $442 billion, the amount of money that we have spent so far on Iraq, we could have provided full four-year scholarships at public universities, public schools, University of Oregon, Michigan State University, major schools, full four-year scholarships to 21 million 451,776 people. Now, I don't know what the college enrollment is in the United States, but I'm guessing that it's it's probably that number or fewer. I don't know. But, that's in Michael Moore's movie Sicko. He points out in France, you go to college for free. In Germany, you go to college pretty much for free. In most European countries, you can go to college for free. All the Scandinavian countries. All the way to PhD. Why? Because they believe that they're investing in their people. What a novel idea. We could have given 21,451,000 full four-year scholarships. Full four-year scholarships. You say, well, we've got a problem with health insurance in this country. With the 442,507,435,612 that we've spent so far in Iraq, we could have provided health insurance at today's absurd and obscene prices, twice as much as any other country in the world pays, for 564,974,550 children for a year. We could have insured 265 million people with the cost of Iraq so far. And if you could cut the cost of that insurance in half so that we're paying what the French are paying, what the Germans are paying, what the British are paying, what the Danes and the Swedes and the Norwegians are paying, we could have insured 600 million people. There's not 600 people living in the United States. That's what the cost of war of Iraq has been. Why isn't anybody talking about this? We know that kids who go through Head Start are less likely to end up in jail, more likely to go to college, more likely to be productive members of society. We could have paid for a full year of Head Start for 58,610,000 kids with the money that we've spent in Iraq so far. We have homeless people in this country. Louise and I were in Seattle a week or two ago. And
there you go, David.
And as we were, you know, walking down the street, there was a line of people lined up for a soup kitchen. You know, clearly homeless people. We could have built 3,984,367 housing units and said, here, you own it now. You take care of it. And if you don't want it, you can sell it, and you can have a little money to live off for a while. And, let's create a market. It would stimulate the economy. It would grow the – just think of the extraordinary things that could have been done with $442 billion. Say, well, we've got a problem. We have a crisis in public education. With that amount of money, we could have hired 7 million teachers. And that's, we're talking full union salaries with pensions and the whole bit, 7,668,716 additional public school teachers for a year with the money that we have spent so far in Iraq. You want to see these numbers? Go over to costofwar.com. It's all right there. And this is using the really conservative number of $442 billion, the amount that has so far been spent in Iraq. The amount that's been appropriated is over $500 billion, over $500 billion. It's amazing. Dave in Los Angeles. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. This morning, Congress, the panel, judiciary panel, cleared the way to start contempt proceedings against Harriet Myers.
Yes, they did, and thank you for pointing it out.
Yesterday, I happened to be listening to Air America, and John Dean was on, and he brought up this little-known procedure called inherent contempt, and I was wondering if you were aware of this, that inherent contempt... It hasn't been used by Congress since 1934 against the Postmaster General. They can convene as a court, and they can find her guilty, and the sergeant-at-arms is directed out and arrests her, brings her in, and they can jail her...
For contempt of Congress.
For the length of the term of Congress. Right. And he said he was saying it's time to dust this off, so I immediately called Conyers' office and Linda Sanchez. Conyers had sent out a letter clarifying the procedure. Linda Sanchez has been looking into this since last March or so.
Yep. And she's the one, by the way, who ruled out of order Bush's executive privilege claim yesterday.
Exactly.
Or this morning, excuse me. Yeah.
And the staffer over there was almost giddy and said, yes, we're well aware of it. So it looks there's some hope here. What this does is it'll keep it out of the courts, and clearly the administration's plan is to get this thing into the contempt of Congress into the court system where they have Bush-appointed judges, and they can tie it up until after Bush even leaves office.
Right.
But with this procedure, it could happen almost instantaneously within a week.
Well, here's the very simple thing to do then. Call your members of Congress. You already did it, Dave, so I'm speaking to everybody else who's listening. Call your member of Congress. The number, the absolutely reliable number, 202-225-3121. That gets you every single member of the House and Senate. 202-225-3121. And suggest to them that you would like to see Congress hold Harriet Myers in inherent contempt of Congress and have serious proceedings. Dave, thank you very much for the call and for pointing that out. Under the Radar, the news under the radar. Next with Christy Harvey from the Center for American Progress. Stick around, 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Hey, Air Americans, head over to airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page, or just go to airamerica.com and click on my name. It'll get you to our main page. You'll find links to our message board. You'll find links to our live chat room. And you'll also find our blog. You know, way cool, lots of fun. And we will be picking the coolest blog entry of the day, or David's, what in David Poole's ideas, the best blog entry of the day, whatever. I don't know, his favorite one. And that person will receive a free autographed copy of Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, my new book, or my book that is now newly in paperback. Christy Harvey is with us with the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. She's the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress, and also does the daily news prep site, MikeCheckRadio.org. And Christy, welcome.
Hey, how are you?
I am just great, but I'll get better. Let's check out what's flying under the radar here in the news. The Reverend Lou Sheldon, I understand you've been keeping track of him.
Absolutely. Now, he's one of these nasty types that usually spends his spare time gay bashing. He's the head of one of those aptly named traditional values coalitions, which basically is a front for hate speech and gay bashing and that sort of thing. But this week, he actually took a little time out of his busy schedule to bash the environment. And he has taken on raising the fuel efficiency standards, the CAFE standards.
This is so weird.
This
is so weird. I mean, there's this huge coalition of evangelical groups and mainline Protestant groups, along with the Catholic Church's long, you know, history of supporting environmental causes. I would say that probably the majority of the organized Christian groups in the United States are solidly on the side of protecting the environment and being good stewards of God's creation. And this guy is going to, this Reverend Lou Sheldon, the Traditional Values Coalition, says that air pollution is a traditional value?
Absolutely. His excuse is that families with a lot of kids need to drive big SUVs. And it's not fair to implement the CAFE standards, which will then hurt the auto industries, which then may, I guess, make your SUV go up a couple hundred bucks to buy.
That's
where he's coming down.
Yeah, I was one of four boys. I mean, there were six of us in our family, and my dad just bought a station wagon, and it got pretty good gas mileage. I mean,
heck, my dad threw us in the back of the pickup, and we were fine.
Yeah, well, don't tell anybody that now. I think you just did, but in any case, yeah. So, I mean, it's not that we would recommend that, of course. But, and he's also, didn't he work with Jack Abramoff, this guy, Lou Sheldon?
That's the thing. He's a Reverend Lou Sheldon, and he's definitely a man for hire. And he got swept up last year because it turned out he was secretly taking money from Jack Abramoff to promote gambling. So, as you know, gambling is a very traditional family value. So he got busted by acting as a liaison between Jack Abramoff and Tom DeLay. But that hasn't stopped him. I'm just wondering who's paying the bill for his testimony on the CAFE standards.
Yeah. I'm wondering why anybody still takes him seriously.
Especially since it turned out that Jack Abramoff's nickname for him was Lucky Louie. Once someone calls you Lucky Louie, you don't really have much credibility left.
That should be a sign. That should be something that concerns you. The White House is blocking the Iraq study group from reevaluating their own report. This blows me away.
I was absolutely fascinated by this. It was a small story tucked in the Washington Post today. But a lot of the Republicans have started to jump on the bandwagon of we have to implement the Iraq study group recommendations. Never mind that they're, 6 months old at this point and things have been changing. So the Iraq study group, many of its members want to get back together to do another assessment. Say, this is what's happened so far. Let's reevaluate our recommendations. And Congress, a couple of months ago, overwhelmingly passed a resolution to fund them so they can get back together, but the White House is blocking it. Chris Shays, who is a Republican, came out and said that he thinks that the White House is afraid of what the ISG will come up with if they're allowed to reevaluate.
Wow. Wow. And the White House didn't like their original evaluation. And speaking of Iraq, yesterday, obviously, the Republicans filibustered the bill, Jim Webb's bill to support our troops. But it doesn't stop there.
It doesn't. And this is pretty bad. There was a new article that said that the Defense Department is actually putting U.S. troops back at risk over in Iraq because they awarded the contracts for the really badly needed new armored vehicles over there to companies that have consistently failed to deliver. So they said, you know what, you're always behind the times. You're never on time with a deadline. Why don't you just take this other really expensive contract to do the badly needed SUV vehicles or armed vehicles? It's fine.
Yeah,
so
because your CEO is a good Republican contributor, presumably.
Of course it was. Of course it was. Yeah. So it's just bad news, and it really puts our troops at risk.
Amazing. Christy Harvey, the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, and MikeCheckRadio.org. Christy, thanks so much for sharing with us today.
Thanks a lot.
Great to have you here. 27 minutes past the hour. Our best of the rest of the news segment coming up next.
Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Let's check out the best of the rest of the news. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the segment here every week where we go out and bring in some folks from the blogosphere, from the internet, some of the best bloggers or some of the best web news sites, and explore what they're seeing and hearing and getting a sense of out there in the world. Lori Wallach is with us. She's with TradeWatch.org and Citizen.org. And the director of Public Citizen's Global Trade Watch. Hey, Lori, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Hi.
Great to have you here. And Isaiah Poole is with us. He's the executive editor of TomPaine.com, great news site. Hey, Isaiah, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Glad to have you with us. Lori, first of all, in your opinion, the big stories of the day in the world that you and the websites that you're working with are looking at.
Well, there are a couple of things that aren't making the mainstream media. One is that there's a huge two-day nationwide shutdown strike in Peru in opposition to the U.S.-Peru Free Trade Agreement. And this is very interesting because the Bush administration has been trying to sell that agreement as a great foreign policy initiative. New friendship with Peru, except someone forgot to tell the people in Peru that they actually were going to be more friendly if we stuck them with a NAFTA expansion. So there's it's a huge event, and the whole capital of Lima is basically shut down.
Amazing. I've been to Lima, Peru. That's no small town.
Isn't
it amazing that the people in Lima, Peru get it, that these trade agreements benefit multinational corporations and their CEOs and stockholders and do not benefit nations and do not benefit, workers, people, or if ultimately even the consumers. They only benefit the transnational corporations, the global corporations, and their CEOs and their stockholders. And we don't get that here in the United States. Why do you think that is?
Well, actually, I think the majority of the public gets it. The polling shows that. The 2006 elections, where the majority making freshmen, a lot of them got elected specifically by running against the Republicans' incumbents' votes on NAFTA, CAFTA, and the whole smorgasbord of AFTAs.
But it's never discussed in our media.
Yeah, I think that that has a lot to do with the corporate concentration of our media. I think it has to do with who owns and who is cross-owning other entities and also who's advertising.
Surprise.
I think what's very powerful, though, is sort of the big question of why, given how much the majority of Americans and the freshman Democrats and people in other countries oppose these agreements, why are a handful of the very senior House Democrats considering moving a couple more of those NAFTA expansion agreements with the Bush administration? The majority of the Democrats in Congress, just so everyone's clear, the vast majority oppose any more of these agreements. But there's some attempts to revive Bush's agenda by adding some good labor and environmental provisions, but, you know, adding it to the old NAFTA. The old NAFTA structure. So
I would submit to you that my guess is that those Democrats who are supporting it are doing so because they're getting campaign contributions from the corporations that will benefit from it.
Although it's a lot of leadership people, and so to the extent they'd like to stay the majority, it's kind of a peculiar little twist. I think the other big news story, I would say, that's being missed in the globalization and trade world is in that Peru agreement that people are on the streets against in Peru, there's a provision that would allow Citibank to go to a foreign tribunal and demand compensation from the Peruvian government if Peru reversed its failed Social Security privatization. It's a little complicated for the Democrats who successfully fought against Bush imposing the same kind of program, which sets up private retirement accounts to compete against the government system. This has been in effect in Peru for over 10 years. And just like the Democrats said what happened here, the returns have been lower, the costs have been higher. It's been a total disaster. And so there's a big push to reverse this. And so the Archbishop of Peru and the Labor Federation presidents, the head of the Retirees Council, all called on the Democrats when they were talking to the Bush administration about these agreements to close this loophole to make sure Citibank can't basically chill their attempt to reverse this outrageous privatization. And unfortunately, the Democrats didn't do anything, and so it's in there. So if the agreement passes, Citibank basically could, collect a lot of money for what in technical terms is nationalizing a for-profit service that would be Social Security.
Billions of dollars, presumably.
It's really upsetting, actually. And those are two big items that I think make clear what's at stake with these agreements that the mainstream media has just totally missed the boat on.
Yeah. Lori, thank you. That's great. Isaiah Poole, the executive editor of TomPaine.com. Isaiah, what are the top stories that you're seeing over there at Tom Paine?
Well, we just posted on our site an item by Rick Perlstein, a cornucopia of cons. And I'm a techie guy. I love all things tech. And, of course, I went through iPhone mania just like everyone else. I didn't actually get an iPhone, but I always liked these kinds of stories. Here's one. Broadband growth in the United States has actually slowed from about 40% growth in adoption in 2005 and in early 2006 to about 12%, according to the Pew Center.
Mm-hmm.
In Russia, the broadband market has grown 42%.
Could that just be a case of our market being more mature than theirs?
Or it could be. Here's the thing: the difference between what's happening in the United States is that you have where you have cable being the predominant, becoming the dominant broadband conveyor.
Mm-hmm.
In Russia, it's fiber optic.
Oh, interesting. You mean people have fiber optic coming into their house?
Fiber optic to the house.
Wow, and it's independent of the phone company or of the television company, or is it carrying something else in addition to that?
I don't know all the details, but here's what's interesting about that. In Russia, it's public policy. In the United States, it's private initiative and totally private market.
So the government in Russia is laying the infrastructure. They're putting down the fiber optic.
It's part of their public policy to have broadband penetration. And it's another example of the difference between what happens when you have a government that sort of turns its back on infrastructure and a government that doesn't.
Right, which is what we've seen here in the United States basically since the election of Reagan. We started neglecting our roads and our schools and our hospitals and our air traffic system and everything with Reagan, and it's now everything is starting to fall apart. And the Russians in the last few years, you're saying, are building their infrastructure aggressively.
Right. On the subject of infrastructure, there was just a report released by one of the trade associations of highway building contractors. They were warning, based on figures that they've gotten from the mid-year budget review, that there's going to be a multi-billion-dollar shortfall in the funding, public funding, federal funding for highways and mass transit.
Well, you know, we've got to have tax cuts for billionaires and multimillionaires. It's real simple,
well,
I say.
The other irony is that think back to about 2 or 3 years ago when Congress was debating the highway and mass transit bill, and the one that's now given us the bridge to nowhere.
Right.
Early on, the argument was that if you imposed a 5% tax on gasoline, that would essentially assure you enough of a financial pipeline.
Right.
That you could actually not only repair our existing infrastructure, but begin to put a dent on expanding the road network.
And it hasn't worked for either one, right?
Right. Well, we killed the 5 cent gas tax because we said the public wouldn't stand for
it. Oh my God, it's a tax. I mean, that was the bottom line.
I've got
to move along here. We just have about a minute and a half left, and I want to get from both of you, Lori. What do you see as the stories coming down the road that we need to be attending to that we might not be paying attention to?
Well, Hawaii just became the third state to pass state law excluding itself from some of the outrageous limits on procurement policy in the trade agreement. So that's great for folks in Hawaii. Those include getting rid of the bans on offshoring and renewable energy. Second thing I think is that we could see coming down the road, and there are more states lined up, so we'll see more of that, is probably the Democratic presidential candidates are going to start having to talk about what their real positions are on trade. And if you think about it, in both Iowa and New Hampshire, two House seats per state, Republican longstanding seats went Democratic on the trade issues during 2006, helping deliver the majority. Those are states where the issue's hot and the candidates are going to get pushed to talk about it.
That's great. That's great. Tradewatch.org is a great source for that. And Isaiah Poole, executive editor at TomPaine.com, what do you see coming down the road here?
We're really watching the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and whether he's going to actually let the Republicans filibuster something. We've had this pattern of Republicans do a filibuster, Democrats pull back. Will Harry Reid actually stand firm and let the Republicans potentially hang themselves?
Right, and raise hell about a filibuster. Well, you know, time will tell. We'll see. Isaiah Poole, TomPaine.com, Lori Wallach, Citizen.org, and TradeWatch.org. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Great having you here. 45 minutes past the hour. Senator Kent Conrad up next.
Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. President Bush is pointing to tax cuts as budget deficit dips. This is the headline in the New York Times today, Jim Rittenberg's column. Strong tax revenue has helped shave the federal budget deficit to its lowest level in 5 years, President Bush said Wednesday. something fishy about all this. So I wanted to get Kent Conrad on, Senator Kent Conrad from North Dakota. He's the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, and get his take on these numbers. Senator Conrad, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Thank you very much for coming on. George W. Bush is claiming, first of all, that his budget's going to be coming in just, you know, everything is wonderful. The budget deficit is falling. I'm assuming that there's got to be something funny here.
Well, there are a lot of things funny. The first is the claim, because,
okay,
you know, what's happening is the deficit, he says, now will go up this year, $205 billion. And he's saying it's a big improvement from the $244 billion he said it was going to be earlier. Look, he's done this every year for the last 4 years. He says the deficit will be a certain amount in February, and then he lowers the amount in July so that he can claim that there's been big improvement. There hadn't been any improvement. He just inflated it to begin with.
Yeah.
So this is an old budget trick. But the larger reality, of course, is that the president's fiscal plan has been a complete and utter disaster for this country. He's increased the debt from about just under $6 trillion to $9 trillion in just 6 years. So the guy's increased the debt 50%. And he's done it at the worst possible time, right before the baby boomers retire. And his outsized tax cuts to the wealthiest among us have been a major contributor to these deficits and growth of the debt. And he's trying to stand truth and fact on its head and claim that the giant tax cuts to the wealthiest among us have reduced the deficit. No, no, no. We had surpluses before he came into office, big surpluses. And he turned it all into massive deficits and record debt.
Now, I assume that these estimates, this $205 billion, et cetera, that these estimates, just like for the last three or four administrations, I mean, basically going back to Reagan when this practice started, don't include the money that's also being borrowed from the surpluses in the Social Security Trust Fund.
Oh, Don, Tom, how right you are. What he's doing here is leaving out a whole category of increase in debt. That is, he's not counting the money that he is taking from Social Security. This year alone, almost $190 billion, all of which is going to have to be paid back, none of which counts in his deficit calculation. So while he says the deficit's going to go up $205 billion, the debt is going to go up $513 billion, because he's raiding every trust fund in sight. He's been doing this a long time. He's taken trillions from Social Security and used it to pay other bills. If you were doing this in the private sector, you'd be on your way to a Washington or a federal institution, but it wouldn't be the Congress and it wouldn't be the White House. You'd be on your way to the big house.
It would be a crime.
Yeah, that'd be a violation of federal law. You can't take, if you were in a private sector, Tom, you know this, you can't take the retirement funds of your employees and use it to pay other bills. I mean, that's not kosher.
Well, and on top of that now, if my understanding is correct, also not included in this budget deficit number is all the off-budget stuff that has been appropriated for Iraq.
Yeah, we don't yet know. We've been told he's going to come with another supplemental. That is another request for funds for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's not in these numbers. The one that he's already asked for is in these numbers, the one he's already gotten, but we're told he's going to come with another one, which, of course, isn't in these numbers. And, you know, we've already spent or committed so far over $570 billion for Iraq and Afghanistan, and the Congressional Research Service just came out with new numbers that said even if you radically cut back troop levels going forward, you'd still have another $400 billion roughly $440 billion more on top of the $577 billion we've already committed. So low end, you're talking about $1 trillion.
And, Senator Conrad, how much of that is off budget? How much of that is not showing up in these deficit numbers?
Well, what has already been committed shows up in these numbers. What we don't know is what supplemental requests he'll make later this year. And, you know, typically that's been in the tens of billions of dollars.
Yeah, or you know, sometimes approaching $100 billion. Why does the media allow him to get away with this?
Because they really don't want to do budget stories very badly, you know. You really have to do your homework to do these kinds of stories. And
but Jim Rutenberg's no dummy, you know, at the New York Times.
I tell you, part of it is things have really changed. They always want to talk about the deficit as a percentage of GDP, and they never include in the calculation the growth, the Social Security money that's being used. And, you know,
we need to change
fact,
it.
The reality
Senator, I'm
is
sorry,
changed.
We've run up to the end of the show. I really appreciate you coming by, Senator Kent Conrad of North Dakota. Thanks so much.
Good to be with you.
Good to have you on the show, sir. 56 minutes past the hour. Coming up tomorrow, Anything Goes Friday, plus Senator Bernie Sanders will be here for the entire first hour taking your calls. And, by the way, don't forget, Seattle's Progressive Talk, AM 1090, is bringing 6 national talk show hosts to Seattle Town Hall this Saturday for a special AM 1040 forum, Perfect Presidents or Perfect Politicians. It's a one-night event with special guests Stephanie Miller, Ed Schultz, the Young Turks, Mike Malloy, and me. I'll be the moderator. Tickets are already sold out, but you can watch the live webcast of the event on AM1090Seattle.com the night of the show. It's Saturday night at 7 p.m. And I'll be in Grand Rapids for a special live broadcast book signing Friday at the Celebration Cinema North. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Call your member of Congress and say, how about holding these guys in contempt of Congress? 202-225-3121, a good number to start with. Anyhow, tag, you're it. Take good care. We'll see you tomorrow.